Whereas local areas, three-fourths of the energy falling on the ground or released in the air is man-made, and only one-fourth solar. On a global basis, the energy released by man is only one part in 25,000 of the solar input. And so there is a substantial difference between what the atmosphere can accept and what we try to force it to accept locally. Next slide, please. This slide then shows the heat balance of the Earth and the atmosphere and the proportion in which man's activities would add to a small and insignificant fraction of the heat burden of the atmosphere. Next slide. Well, this is one way in which the regeneration of waste heat, or the rejection of waste heat into the deep waters of the ocean, can be successfully done without upsetting the environment. Below about 300 feet depth, the ocean is unmixed and very much lower in temperature than the surface waters. If our waste heat are injected into that water and then released, say it's heated then to the surface temperature and released there, we have not affected the oceanic environment, and the ocean's time constant for this is very long, like 5 years, which it would sense any change in its internal heat balance. So the ocean can act as a tremendous distributor of our waste. So we can take advantage of the enormous capacity of the atmosphere to reject heat to space. And to successfully do this for our cities, luckily many of them are near the ocean, we then have to have these big regional interties to carry a lot of the energy inland. Now, this is looking far into the future. There will have to be interim solutions. We can't jump immediately to this approach. But if we knew it were coming, we could approach it more efficiently. Next slide. I think I'll skip the rest of the slides. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hammond. That was certainly a new and interesting thing to look at. We'll now hear from Mr. Vukasin of the California Public Utilities Commission.
Thank you, Mr. Barnes. I'd like to make one preliminary observation before getting into my notes. It's directed to Mr. Sporn's Table 4A, Item 1, which was concerned with population control. As the father of five relatively young children, in my usual objective, impersonal, scholarly fashion, I reject out of hand and without further consideration your recommendation of income tax disincentives. I really am pleased to be here, very happy to be here. With a legal background, I've never had the opportunity to meet most of you and to meet with this organization. I've been tremendously impressed with the quality and the nature of your proceedings. I read the list of papers that were read at this morning's various meetings presented. I have to admit, I really did not understand most of them. People say that about some of my decisions, so don't feel bad about it. Preparing for this panel discussion has been most beneficial to me. As many of you know, we in California are deeply involved in these questions, and my commission itself is deeply involved. I took this occasion to do a substantial amount of research and study and reading, essentially a cram course on the subject. I started with Mr. Sporn's paper. Then I read perhaps 40 or 50 other documents, magazine articles, papers that have been presented and written by others, documents that have been prepared, reports and studies, and I have to admit I was spoiled. I started with Mr. Sporn's document, went to the others, and I had to go back to Mr. Sporn's document to find a discussion in such depth, and also which came out with specific concrete proposals and programs. It's been my experience that most of the material written on the subject reminds me of one word, essentially platitudes. Everyone talks in circles about the subject, but very few people get right down to the nub of it. I'm tempted to paraphrase Winston Churchill's statement when he said, "Never have so many owed so much to so few." And I would paraphrase that to say, "Never have so many written so much and said so little." I was tremendously interested in your international president, Mr. Gordon's comments at noontime today, and one word particularly impressed me, the word priorities. To me, this is the key of the solution to the problems which we have. Without priorities, it would be, I don't think, that we can, in an orderly fashion, accomplish our objectives. The dilemma we're faced with, I think, is best indicated by a letter which a governor of one of our western states wrote to a constituent of his. This gentleman wrote complaining about a fossil fuel plant that was being constructed near his residence. And the governor, who remained unidentified at this time, replied, acknowledging receipt of the letter of complaint, and discussed some technical aspects of it, and concluded with this paragraph: "My only comment on your plea to eliminate fossil fuel burning plants is summed up in the fact that the East is now experiencing power shortages, with the Sierra Club banning dams and hydro projects, and others opposed to nuclear plants, and you against fossil fuel. We may have the clearest skies in the day and the darkest farms, villages, and cities at night which the world has ever seen. There are only three ways of producing electricity, and all three are now under attack. The West needs electric power, and it has to be produced in one of three ways. If all three attacking groups are successful, what do you suggest?" Signed, Curiously. Essentially, we find ourselves, you and our organization to the same, to a different extent, damned if we do and damned if we don't. Mr. Sporn, a little while ago, made an observation that his paper last year drew some caustic comments and some not complimentary reaction. I would invite you to join us on the California Commission. When we issue a decision on this subject, we receive communications from irate legislators, indignant housewives, unhappy industrialists, officials of mosquito abatement districts. I don't know how they get in there. And then you go home and your wife says, "I heard on the radio what you did today. How could you ever do such a dumb thing?" Mr. Sporn, not being an engineer, I'm going to take the liberty of directing my comments not necessarily as a critical analysis or of the contents of your paper. I would like to take the liberty of adding one more element, if I may. Our problem, yours and mine, is to bring order to this chaos. I think we should direct our attention to the priorities, which Mr. Cooper referred to. I think we have to approach the problem in a scholarly fashion, in a professional manner, objectively, logically, and rationally. Unfortunately, this is not a solely scientific problem. It's an emotional problem and a personal problem. And I believe it's from this factor that many of our problems arise. In trying to take an objective approach to arrive at our solutions, we have come to our first major problem in our accomplishment. Not all people who are active in this problem are objective and rational and logical. It's unfortunate, but this is a conclusion that I have arrived at. I would divide all active people in the area of environment, conservation, ecology, and so on into four general groups. The first group would be those who are concerned and sincerely motivated, but I cannot give them the credit for being objective or rational or logical. These people have preconceived notions based on usually some personal or historical factor. They are not willing to listen to the other side. They're not looking for a solution. They have decided what the solution is, and only on their terms will they be satisfied. There is a second group, which I regretfully have come to the conclusion, is not sincerely motivated. These people are not concerned with conservation. These people are concerned with destruction. I would put them in the category of the anti-establishment type person. They are not environmentalists, they are destructionists. And they are attracted by any public cause which may serve their purpose. These people I have no difficulty in rejecting out of hand. The third group is the large mass of people who are sincerely concerned but apathetic. These are the people who recently have become concerned about the environmental problems, but they are not really active. They talk about it, they read about it in the paper, but they don't do anything. The fourth group, and I'm coming closer to home now, is those people who are concerned, who are objective, and who are involved. This includes many volunteers, people who, in their spare time, so to speak, concern themselves with boards, commissions, clubs, committees, in trying to solve the problems of our environment. It also includes you, by virtue of your profession, your business activities, your personal activities. It involves me because of the position that I happen to be in our state government. Having identified these groups, I would submit that the solution can best be accomplished by this last group, you and I and the others who are sincerely concerned and take an intelligent approach to the problem. To one, establish their priorities. Two, with determination and commitment, two words that I saw in your chart, Mr. Sporn. With determination and commitment, involve and galvanize the support of that third group, the concerned but apathetic. Without their support, you will have difficulty. With their support, you will accomplish your objective. So I guess what I am saying in essence is I would add the new element of public relations to the technological approach to the problem. There's no question in my mind that we can accomplish our objectives, primarily with your help. Without broad public support for sound solutions, which you will arrive at, productive efforts will be thwarted, funds will be diverted, our goals will be obscured, and the results, if they are achieved, will be delayed an unnecessary and undesirable period of time. I am satisfied in my own mind that we can find our solutions and accomplish our objectives. I think that right here in this room, now, today, there is probably the scientific knowledge and the brain power to find our solutions. Rather awesome, isn't it? But I am convinced that this is the situation, and I'm most impressed with the fact. In essence, what I would say is, I know we can, I am sure we will. The only question is, how soon? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Vukasin. I think that was a very beautiful and very clear summing up of the situation. We'll now hear from Mr. Frederick H. Warren, Advisor on Environmental Quality for the Federal Power Commission.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. By way of opener, I'd like to commend the IEEE and Mr. Sporn for the number of people here to review and entertain this thesis. And I would say, Mr. Sporn, that if, as we were saying at the break, if a reasonable number of these people would take your program and proceed to implement it, I think we'd have far less problems when the group would meet 5 or 10 years from now. Certainly, Mr. Sporn has presented a major thesis comprehensively and challengingly. And there's so much of it with which I agree, including, I may say, population stabilization program and the program for industry, perhaps in even more intensive scale than Mr. Sporn outlined, but so much of it that he has spoken of that I agree with that I'll not spend my brief time in rehashing the points where we are in agreement. Rather, I would like to pick up a cue from one major thing which Mr. Sporn has said, the role of technology in finding this way to the future, and I would like to step on this premise and from it express a few perspectives from my point of view. Yes, I think technology is the way to this future, but only, and I emphasize only, if it is exercised in its very broadest role, the very broad role of finding where the public interest truly lies and in persuading the public that that's where the public interest lies. And as we've heard from Mr. Vukasin very often, and from others, very often the public is not convinced that the technologist really knows where the public interest lies. This requires a quality of leadership and understanding which is very much needed beyond the technical capabilities which we have in such abundance. And really the question is, will the leadership of this very vital industry justify its role of leadership by demonstrating this broadly based social consciousness in solving the technical problems, not only of this century, but even this 21st century toward which we must now look? Let's go back to some figures that Mr. Sporn quoted, that about 23% of today's energy is electrical energy, and by the year 2000, let us say this grows to 50%. This is in general agreement with what other people say. Now, doesn't that by itself indicate that with such escalation in the focus of the nation's spotlight on the activities and the leadership of this industry, the test of that leadership is very, very real? And I would like to indicate some major problems which I think can only be solved by an exercise of industrial statesmanship of a most unique and superb quality. I refer to one current issue. A very comprehensive study is needed of the total national energy resources of this country, including the availability of different fuels and different quantities and over periods of time at different economic demand levels. Such a study was proposed earlier this year by the chairman of the Federal Power Commission speaking to Congress. The idea has since been seconded by other commissioners of the Federal Power Commission. It's an idea, a concept of essential merit and requirement. It has both public and private interest behind it. But with an industry which anticipates being a purveyor of 50% of the energy of this country by the end of this century, there must be a leading and dynamic opinion of this industry that such a study of this is necessary to guide the plans of the future. To see that such a thing is pursued, not merely through government, but through the most effective participation of private industry as well. And in this process of evaluating this energy resource picture through whatever organization, it'd be essential that the environmental factors in the use of different fuels and different systems be effectively studied. A second area is that old shibboleth, but a very important one, R&D in this industry. Now, we need waste no time on words about the need for increased research and development. The things that have been talked of today and many months past demonstrate it. They relate to improved equipment, more efficient use of fuels, the influence of environmental problems on design, on location of plants, transmission lines, the evolution of new generating and supply systems. And I think almost anyone here would stipulate with me right now that the level of funding for R&D of the electric power industry, however you measure it today, is inadequate to the tasks which lie before us. Therefore, query what to do about it. How can an industry which has the design tasks before it, the designated tasks before it, fail but to come up with a solution? It's not just a rehash of an old idea, it's a question of what's going to be done about it. My own view is that the type of R&D institution needed is something which doesn't now exist. It's true there are committees working hard in this industry. This is not a solution for industry committees. It's a solution for an effective, technically, scientifically, and engineering-oriented establishment. Should be industry-oriented. Should be funded at a level several times the present level. Should have continuity. Should have established scientific and engineering competence, committed to the short and long-term problems of this industry. If the industry should, by any chance, for antitrust reasons, need legislation or whatever, and I don't know that it does, whatever it needs, the opportunity is here, the need is here, I would say this is a problem for leadership. Third, I come to a more far-out kind of question, energy supply in the very long term. Suppose you are an entrepreneur. would you promote a business on the premise that all of your invested capital was all the capital that you intended to use in the next umpteen years of your career? You had no plans for replenishing that capital as time went on. That's really the way this country operates on its energy system to a large extent. Here we are, the greatest consumer and producer of energy, and in that position, 90% of the energy comes from mineral resources which are being used up, cannot be replenished by any system we know. Coal is, we're told, is good for perhaps 1 to 2 centuries from now. Oil and gas far less assured than that. And yet the rate of consumption are increasing dramatically. The only renewable sources of energy we have are hydro and solar, and the latter still very impractical. So that less than 10% of our expected power needs of the next generation come from renewable energy sources. Now, considering the total environmental context and the mission of conservation of our resources, isn't this something we need to do something about, to begin to do something about, so that sometime in the long term we get to a point of being in equilibrium on a self, hopefully a self-sustaining basis, or at least not a capital wasting basis to the extent we are now? It's not a 10-year program, not a 25-year program, but maybe a century's program. That would require an acceleration of programs which are not now very practical. Breeder reactors must be moved forward, fusion energy, upgrading of solar energy, MHD or other types of improvement in the efficiency of fossil fuel systems, other exotic forms not yet known. I think we're going to want to do more with hydro, which has gotten a little unpopular. We need means of storing energy other than pump storage, which is about the only practical system we have today. How will we pay for it, you say? We're now borrowing nature's capital against the future. And the technological answers to the points that I've raised will be very costly. Well, just for a thought, why not start to pay that cost now, like the environmental costs which we need right now to factor into our power bills, and will, I'm sure, be doing very currently. Suppose that all the mineral fuels which we are extracting now and borrowing from the future had to bear a development tax to recognize that we are borrowing against the future, and to provide a trust fund for R&D to find the renewable forms of energy of the future. Is this very far out? Well, just think about what you might want to tell your great-great-grandchildren about what you did with the energy resources that you are using up today. Well, these are some horizons of technological leadership which are very broad, perhaps even far out. But as Phillips Bourne says, we have to start. And why not start now while we still have so much of nature's wealth here to enjoy at the present time? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Warren. Certainly our resources and our research are important items. Now, Mr. Watson, Manager of Power of the Tennessee Valley Authority.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, Phil Sporn again has given us his usual statesman-like talk and has really gone straight to the heart of the environmental challenge that the electrical industry faces today. I think I agree with most of what Mr. Sporn has said. I agree that the loads of the industry are going to continue to grow very rapidly in the next 10, 20, or 30 years. I agree that the electric systems have an enormous construction job ahead of them. I agree that the new facilities should be designed so as not to intrude unnecessarily on the environment. And further, because some of the facilities built in the past do intrude on the environment, it seems reasonable that steps should be taken to improve them, keeping in mind, of course, that we should direct our efforts and money into the directions that will result in the maximum benefit. As I see it, these are the premises on which Phil
rested his recommendations, and I agree. However, I do have reservations about some of his specific recommendations, and I admit also that in some instances I would place the emphasis somewhat differently than Phil has done in his presentation. It seems to me that one of the most useful tasks which we could do here today and at similar meetings in the future is to discuss as specifically as possible the things that the electric industry should say when discussing environmental problems with others. I think we need to identify more clearly than we have in the past the areas of misunderstanding and misconception among those outside of the industry that are not as familiar with the problems as we are. And we need to clear up these misunderstandings. I believe we're going to be judged more by our actions than by our words. Consequently, I especially agree with the strength of Phil's insistence that electric systems take the initiative and do something about their environmental problems and to begin that action immediately. I like his idea of setting targets and timetables for correcting things that can be corrected. And I also agree with his recommendation for a strong research program, the same sort of thing that Fred was talking about here. The technology already exists for doing something about fly ash, the particulates in stack gases. And I assume that every electric system is installing electrostatic precipitators in its new coal-burning plants. But we just have to do more than that. Where reasonable, we must install electrostatics in our older plants as well, especially those which are going to operate as with any energy conditions in the shape they are in the United States for a good many years in the future. We have to do something more in the development of control methods related to the sulfur and nitrous oxides. We at the present time on our system have three major research programs going in this field, one in connection and cooperation with the National Air Pollution Control Administration. We would hope that the whole industry would get behind these kind of programs. And I'd like to urge, for instance, that the industry put forth more effort into the work of the Electric Research Council in these particular fields. In fact, it's my feeling that the utility industry should demand a lot more from the Electric Research Council in the environmental area. I think I can say this as a suggestion because I'm a member of that council. This is not criticism. It's a plea to the industry to get behind this thing and get some action out of it. In correcting some of our past errors, we must take advantage of the opportunity such corrections offer to demonstrate our concern for the environment. Even if the improvements we achieve from corrective actions fall short of perfection, we must do the best we can, and we must let the public know what we're doing. We must take action, and we must invite attention to the action that we're taking. Emphasis should be placed on the fact that load growth and the new power facilities which we build to serve that growth are allies of a quality environment improvement, not enemies. Load growth will help support the costly research that Fred was talking about. And the research is going to be so necessary if we're going to succeed in protecting the environment. We must make it clear that our new facilities will incorporate the most modern environmental protective equipment available, and that these new facilities will replace the obsolete ones, which in many instances cannot really be upgraded to the equivalent of the type of environmental facilities we really need. One of the most effective means we have of ridding the industry of facilities that are environmentally objectionable is to cause those facilities to become obsolete technologically, economically, aesthetically. This can be done by research accompanied by growth. One of Phil's recommendations is that we clean up our worst environmental problems during the next 10 years. Well, this is really a very tall order. I agree that we should give special attention to all the problems which will exist over any significant period. And I would hope that we would permit the industry to grow at a rate which would permit us to provide new facilities that would replace the ones that have offended the environment in the past. I think we must develop an awareness that new technology will permit new facilities to be better neighbors than old facilities, and that growth is one of the paths we should follow towards a quality environment. Next, it seems to me that our story of load growth has not been too well understood. Maybe this misunderstanding is not entirely our fault. It may be that we're not presenting the picture in a manner that can be easily comprehended by the public. But I have the impression that the public accepts our forecasts of load growth as production targets, which the electric industry is determined to meet, sort of like a production goal that a sales manager for a shoe factory might set for his sales force and say, go out and sell, sell, sell. I think our public story of load growth should emphasize that the electric utility industry is truly a service industry. Then we should make it clear that our forecasts are not production targets for our salespeople to shoot at, but simply our best estimate of what the public really expects of us. We're not trying to double our capacity every 10 years. It simply looks to us as though we may just have to. It's my belief that the industry should not take the subject of curtailment very seriously. I believe that this could only occur if some sort of national production control is imposed in the country as a whole. I'm not sure that I fully agree with Phil's emphasis on population control, particularly as it relates to the immediate problems in this country, or how the electric utility industry should approach a problem of this kind. Now, I'm not quarreling with Fred or Phil about the fact that that our planet is getting a bit crowded and that something may need to be done about it. Whatever the nation decides to do about population, however, I don't believe it'll make any significant change in our environmental problems in the foreseeable future, or that there is much that the electric industry should or could do on this subject. As Phil points out, we face an enormous load growth, even if we're successful in meeting his standards of population control. Population, for instance, is growing at something, I guess, about 1% a year. But the use of electricity is growing on an average for the country at 8% a year, in many areas 15% a year. Furthermore, any reasonable slowing of population, even if it reduces load growth, will have little impact on the magnitude of the electric industry's environmental challenge on the design, the siting, air and water quality control, thermal discharges, radiation, and undergrounding. Another objection to so heavy an emphasis on population control is that it encourages opposition to the construction of needed power facilities. It tends to create the impression that a slowing of population growth will defer load growth, and that this in turn will permit electric systems to defer some of the construction that we face in the very near future and that we're going to have to meet in one way or another, taking into account as best we can the environmental problems. It's true that at some distant date, if population is stabilized, the amount of things that we build will slow down. It'll influence materially the speed at which new families are formed, new homes are built, electric appliances are purchased, and even the distribution of our population by age groups. In time, it would certainly influence the use of electric energy. But I'm not sure that this is all for the good. I'll not go into this subject any further today. Several people have already talked about it. But it's still my strong belief that growth is the lifeblood of both America and the electric utility business. At any rate, by the time the population influence is felt, we must have long since licked the environmental problems we face today, or we're going to be in real troubles. In the meantime, because population control can't do more than begin to moderate our environmental problems, I suggest that we should be very careful that we don't give the impression that this approach will take care of the problem. Well, I'm not going to speak further today on the basic philosophy of curtailment, even though, as you can see, I feel quite strongly about it. Just let me say, however, that I agree with Phil that if we do our job properly, and I think I quote him correctly here, it is possible to obtain both increased energy for man and the protection of his environment. And this is the point that I think we ought to stress over and over again. But we can do more than this. I believe the electric industry should explain as firmly as possible that the curtailment of electricity production in central stations is not an appropriate way to protect the environment, nor is it an appropriate way to curtail our consumption of natural resources, in my opinion. A breakdown in central service station service will lead to economic catastrophe and urban chaos without offering a sensible way to protect the environment. I'm convinced in my own mind that our quality of life depends upon energy. In producing energy, we must pay more attention to our natural ecology, but we must not lose sight of our human ecology. I believe this emphasizes the need for us all to get busy right now at finding ways of controlling these environmental problems. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Watson. I think you did very well, especially in the last man on the docket, which is always the toughest one program. May I have an indication in order to plan the discussion period of how many may wish to ask questions? Could you raise your hands, please? Well, that doesn't seem to create any problems. Okay. Well, I think there's probably another kind of pollution around here. Maybe I create the name of seat pollution. Why don't we take a 1 minute stand up and the local people can say a few prayers for the Dodgers and I'll concentrate on the New York Yankees. So.
Curtailment worries you, James.
You what?
Curtailment policy worries you, and I understand that.
This is...
Hi.
I believe in order to give the monitors a chance,
how's everything going?
I'll try to come across the room. There are four microphones, one here, one here, one here, and one here. And we'll start over here. Now, if this is being taped and recorded, if you wish to have your name in the records, will you please state it when you get up? And also, it would be most helpful if you could designate the panelists that you would prefer to answer your questions. Do I see someone over here now? Mr. Lischer?
My name is Lischer. I'm with Commonwealth Edison Company in Chicago. I would think that those of us in this room here, if we exclude the question of birth control, it probably wouldn't be too hard to reach some semblance of agreement on what needs to be done to clean up the environment and even to have reasonable agreement on priorities. But it seems to me that in getting on with this task, there are what I would call two major impediments or roadblocks that we need to deal with. And this is really my question: how do we deal with these two roadblocks? One is the regulatory. There is a great multitude of agencies that give, in many instances, unilateral and sometimes conflicting pronouncements. And any specific company deals with dozens of these agencies and theoretically is supposed to comply with all of them. Somehow, we need to bring some sanity and order into this structure. How do we do that? Secondly, I think we need to learn how to deal with the small but highly vocal irrational groups. The reason they are so important is that they are so dramatic and they demand the attention of the news media and they get it. And this is what appears as great spreads in newspapers and magazines, and this is also what is read by the group that was referred to as the group that is apathetic. But this is what they are confronted with and see. There is no magic in the solution of our problems. I would say that the role of the engineer certainly has terrifically expanded, and this is as much of the problem as is the technology that is involved.
Mr. Vukasin, I think perhaps you could best field that one. Would you like to?
If you have the answer to how to deal with the irrational element, you have all of my time that you would want. I'll listen to you. I'll come to Chicago. I don't know the answer to that one. I think there is a built-in problem with 50 state regulatory agencies, a multitude of local regulatory agencies, the federal regulatory agencies. To me, it's just a matter of each of them committing themselves to expediting their efforts to find a solution and directing their efforts to do it as efficiently as they can. How you encourage this multitude of different agencies to do that, I don't know. Probably the results of this meeting. Many people will go back to their respective areas and in their areas of endeavor will deliver this message and pass it on. Did anyone ever tell you people that story about when the engineer and the physician and the lawyer got together and they were arguing about which was the oldest profession? Well, we directed our attention to try to bring some order out of this. A physician, an engineer, and an attorney were arguing one day about which was the oldest profession. You've all heard the usual jokes about the oldest profession, but this was an unusual one. Physician said he was physician claimed he was, from his profession, was the oldest, and he referred to the healers in ancient Egypt, and there was discussion about Plato and the philosopher kings and the legal aspects of that, and there was some discussion about the engineering feats of the ancient countries. And finally, the physician decided that he would put an end to this discussion. He said, I'll point out to you, gentlemen, that God created Eve by taking a rib from Adam, and that's a surgical procedure. And therefore, I've established and I've solved this discussion that medicine is the oldest profession. The engineer quickly spoke up. He says, I'd like to point out to you that this event took place in the Garden of Eden. And you realize the Garden of Eden was created by God. He created this order out of chaos. At which point, the attorney couldn't contain himself anymore. He said, aha, and just who do you think created that chaos?
Mr. Warren, would you care to comment to that point?
Well, Mr. Lisher knew he had a tough question because there are not very immediate solutions to it, but I think one could look at the answers hopefully in three dimensions. One, if companies, the advocates for building facilities, can prepare their cases well in advance, well documented, and I mean with respect not only to nuclear plants, which already have this discipline, but to other types of plants as well, hopefully the story they tell will be persuasive to the public and to the public bodies who will be moving, who have regulatory functions or who may acquire them in the future. The states, those with initiative and broad concern for the problems, particularly such as California here, New York, and some others as well, are moving, as you know, to trying to put a focus on the regulatory apparatus within the states and hopefully establishing a unified review process, which might reduce some of the time factors. Finally, I think it's not illogical that at some point one would anticipate there be a sort of expressed national policy about the need for certain levels of energy supply being established, and that this would put some official backing to the need to get answers and decisions made on plants at given periods of time.
Thank you, Mr. Warren. Now, can we have a question out of the center front section here? We have someone there.
Hello? Oh. My name is Brian White. I'm from Montreal. One thing disturbed me today, and that is more of an omission than a commission or statement by any of the speakers, and I must admit that I may have missed one or two of the things said today. Mr. Sporn, I remember stating that some utilities have an unending view of the growth rate and made the statement that surely somewhere there is a limit to the expansion of the growth of power or the energy use. I have the feeling at times that maybe we have passed the necessary level in the use of power or energy to establish not a standard of living, but a necessary good standard of life. Now, I heard an awful lot today about the need for production, the importance of great production, the use of energy, and in my limited travels around the world, I don't recall ever seeing that there was, above a certain level, that there was a necessary direct relationship between the productivity and the use of energy and the quality or evident quality of life of the inhabitants. And I think there may be a point here in which we should be backing off on some of the demands we're putting on the power industry and other energy sources in the use of them. I don't think it relates to quality of life or the standard of life necessarily.
Mr. Gould, I think would like to comment to your point, Brian.
I will comment. First of all, I'd be the first to stipulate that there are a lot of end uses of our product that are not necessary for the quality of life. I think that I can still brush my teeth with a motion of the arm. I'm not sure that I need to carve meat with an electric knife. There are quite a few of these things. Curiously enough, the utilities have been criticized quite a bit for their marketing programs. An interesting fact that may not be known to you is that we as a utility have never marketed what I will call the frivolous devices, and I, at the risk of offending someone who may manufacture them, I would include the electric toothbrush and some of these other things in frivolous devices. Likewise, surprising enough, for the last 3 years, we have not pushed as a marketing effort air conditioning. Now, this might surprise you because many utilities do. But what is interesting about this is that when we stopped any effort at market developing of for air conditioning, and I think air conditioning does add to the quality of life in some climates, it had no effect upon the sales. The sales of air conditioners continued. My thesis here is this, that I believe, really, that this is out of the hands of the electric utility to a large degree, because people have learned the value of an electric servant. The manufacturers of such servants have learned their value and their attractiveness to the customer. And I think this lifts it out of the hands and the power of the electric utility. Certainly, if you were to apply a policing or control action to it, we would be powerless to do it.
Mr. Sporn?
Well, this raises a point that I think is at the heart of this misunderstanding on the part of our society in general about this business of electric energy, who uses it, and what it does for our society. I thought I'd cover that, but apparently I didn't. In the first place, it's important to point out again, apropos of Mr. Gould's point, that he still uses an ordinary toothbrush, that domestic use, residential use of energy, is only about 30% of our total energy use. And some 55% goes into industry, and the other 15% goes into commerce. Now, the important element of productivity is very badly understood and needs to be understood, certainly by every person in the United States, every intelligent person, and I would think that I don't see how a man can be really an effective engineer of any kind without understanding productivity. The thing that gives us the society that we have, specifically, the thing that gives us our homes, the thing that gives us our automobiles, and let's assume in many cases they're indispensables, the thing that gives us our high schools, the thing that gives us our colleges, the thing that gives us our great research laboratories, including such institutions as the National Institutes of Health and other important research centers to the welfare and indispensable to our welfare, is our productivity. Productivity means merely what you get in out of an hour's of labor. The fact, as I pointed out, that we were able to increase our productivity in a period of 60 years fourfold meant, having done that and having reduced our labor, the amount of labor we did per week, slightly, not very much, we then were faced with a lot of things that we could do with that increased productivity. We could shorten our work week, which we did. We could raise our wages. And raising wages meant that you were taking some of this productivity, you see, and giving it to yourself. We could go ahead and help our neighbors, all kinds of people, by billions of dollars worth of help a year. We could go up and establish Social Security. We could start cleaning up, although make a very, very bad start, and cleaning up our slums. All of these are means to a better life. Now, you say the better life doesn't mean merely eating and sleeping and spending the rest of the time listening to Beethoven symphonies, you see, four times a day, you see. That's one way of spending your time. But you can spend your increased productivity in these other socially productive ways. We don't have enough productivity to do all the socially necessary things that we have set up programs for. We just don't make enough. And we're not going to make more by working more hours. So we can only make more by working more productively. This is the important item in productivity. And there is no way of getting productivity in our society or in any other modern society by making people work harder, that we're not going to make them sweat more, carry more, tug more, climb more, lift more. They're going to have this increased productivity by giving them tools, very complex tools, complex production schemes, complex factories, many of them automated, and this is going to take energy. This is why we need productivity, because we want to have a better life. But a better life means that we're going to clean up Harlem. And it'll take hundreds of millions of dollars to clean up the Harlems of the United States. And this apparently is very difficult to get across. We cannot do anything without productivity. When we get the productivity, we can do anything we want with it. We can dedicate it all to research in space. It would be a piece of folly, but we could do that. But first, we must get the productivity.
Thank you very much, Mr. Sporn. We have a gentleman in the front here.
I'm Fred Dory, a student with LA Water and Power. And several of you spoke of massive plans to decide what the overall energy allotments requirements of the United States should be, or the world, in several years in the future. My question is, well, aside from the fact that who would decide this and what would the composition of the people that decide it be, I mean, in terms of what industries they're from, and as we might guess, electric power apparently will play a very great part and increase its percentage of the power use in the future. How would we go about, if we have a rational plan that appears to be good, how do we go about telling other industries that, I'm sorry, your percentage of the power is going to have to decrease because you are too dirty, too pollutive, to some other thing? I mean, practically, how will we go about this?
Oh, here we come again. Mr. Warren, sounds to me that's in your area.
Well, I think perhaps the gentleman read too much into the comments about the need for studies, let us say, of the future of energy use in this country and energy resources. To me, that does not mean that some select group of wise men are going to sit down in a closed chamber and hatch out a plan and open the door and say to the waiting world, this is your allocation of energy for the next 20 years in these different categories of fuels. No, and I don't know that you meant quite that either, but what I'm pointing to is that as a basis for determining, for example, what levels of fuels industry might anticipate being available for different uses at different cost levels, one really needs a fairly comprehensive study of what are the total resources potentially available, and to have some idea, some further elaboration of the relative importance of these fuels in the sense of priorities, four different uses to which they are applicable. There are certain things, number of things for which you can use gas that you can't use coal. There are things for which you can use petroleum that you can't use nuclear fuels, and so on. And one doesn't, again, make flat allocations of these uses, but by revealing publicly and exposing publicly what these resources may be, by factoring into the cost of these fuels and their various uses, the real cost from an environmental standpoint, then industry begins to formulate plans and lay down long-range programs for investment of capital for the facilities that use these things, and the decisions by and large are made by a combination of private and public judgments as to what makes sense in a whole series of given situations. Not very clear, but I think it's that kind of a process.
Mr. Hammond indicates he would like to speak to that point also.
Well, I was just going to say that the one-word answer to who settles this is the marketplace, because our ability to utilize energy depends on doing so in the way that makes the economy function. And we are seeing a projection of, for instance, nuclear power assuming a larger part of the economy, because we are entering upon an area where the fuel consumed in nuclear power is a small fraction of the cost of power. And when we get to the breeder reactors, the fuel consumption will be essentially zero or very small, and the only cost of power will be in the mechanical equipment necessary to produce and distribute it. This is a new change in the economics of power, and will make in itself possible the decisions on how different energy forms are utilized.
I'd like to say a word on that too, if you might. I think the industries is kidding themselves if they think that they can tell a manufacturer how much electric energy he's going to use in the production of his whatever he makes. He's going to make it in the most economical way he can, and he doesn't care how much load he places on your system, and he's probably not even going to tell you he's doing it beforehand. I think we're also kidding ourselves if we think that our wives are going to do without washing machines and dishwashers and that sort of thing. And I think that if you take a look at our area, for instance, it has an average use of more than twice the average use of the United States as a whole, it's pretty clear that we're nowhere near the place yet where we're wastefully using electricity. This, I think, is real clear in an area that was really a depressed area of the United States, that the use of energy and the availability of energy is a very great factor in the growth and development of the people. And I think we got a perfect example, and if the industry doesn't see this, I think they're just plain kidding themselves.
Mr. Gould?
In any discussion of limiting the amount of energy or electrical energy available to any given sector of the society, I think you have to remember one thing, that there is a contribution that energy makes to environment. Ponder the situation for a moment in Southern California. If we were to have a limitation on power during a heavy rain, power pumps the rainwaters. That is, we would be up to our armpits in many places in water. Think of what would happen if we could not grind the garbage or if we could not process the sewage. That is, when we talk about a limitation in power, let's remember that there is an area where power contributes to the quality of environment, actually makes the environment, and its absence would deteriorate the environment very, very badly. I think the calm comment that Phil Hammond made about the smung is probably appropriate here.
I would like to point out that while agreeing in every way with Jim Watson, for example, and some of the others, there is no question that we'd be in deep trouble in a free society such as we are in normal times, in anything but in an ultranational emergency, say as fighting a war that is life or death, so to speak, for the nation. In any attempt of setting up any kind of controls, say we've talked, and we're not, certainly not going to do anything, about setting up credit controls as a means of fighting inflation. The question is, who is going to control the controls? This is the real thing. Who's going to tell a man, yes, you can have some money to build what you want to build, you, Bill, but you, John, you can't. This nation isn't going to stand for it. Or, yes, we'll actually control the materials. We'll give you the steel to build this beautiful office building, but we won't give you the steel for building this nursing home, you see. We just won't stand for it. And we won't get anywhere with the control of energy on that basis either. But this does not mean that it isn't possible to reduce energy use by some action that would raise no such problems. For example, we might find that industry is making glass electrically in a certain way. And there's a better way of making electrical glass that requires less electric energy. This actually has happened in glass making. We might find this even in making electric steel. Contrary to the notion that the steel makers know all there is to be known about it, it's conceivable that the research program would show that there's a way of cutting off 300 kilowatt hours per ton of steel. And if that can be done, maybe that's what we ought to do. I'm not sure that in the electric power industry, we've done enough of that. We've satisfied ourselves that the decision made by the steel company is undoubtedly the best decision. They know best, but they may or may not. And in England, for example, a great deal of work has been done on more efficient energy use and the reduction of coal requirements at a time when they had a serious crisis problem in supplying all the coal they needed. So I do think that we need to differentiate it between the two. The question is, who's going to control it? Who's going to say who gets what is a very important question in our kind of society, and the answer is it isn't going to be done except in the case of ultra crisis, which we hope we'll never run into again. But I don't know whether that'll be so or not.
Mr. Vukasin?
One of the reasons for my participating in this proceeding today was to recognize your ability to solve the problems we have in generating electrical energy, and to encourage you, all of you, to dedicate yourselves to do this as rapidly and as efficiently and as effectively as you can. Now, the idea of rationing electrical energy is a shocking suggestion to some people, and it was much more shocking just a few years ago, but now we recognize that it may not be such a remote possibility. We're going to have to ration electrical energy, perhaps, if we are unable to solve the problem of the side effects from the creation and generation of this energy. And what I'm hoping we'll do is to solve the side effects that result from the generation so that we can provide the necessary energy for our society. Let the society decide how much they want and how much they need. And we'll be able to provide it, provided the generation of that energy does not contribute to the pollution of the environment. That's our project. So that's why I say select your priorities, establish your programs, galvanize the support of the intelligent segments of our society, and proceed with great rapidity. This would be what I would hope for.
Thank you. You seem to touch off the panel, at least. I have a written question here in order. Lynn Olmsted of Electrical World handed me several minutes ago. It's addressed to Mr. Sporn, and ask him to clarify what he means by individual ownership of transmission systems. Undivided ownership. Should we interpret this to mean a government-owned common carrier grid?
Well, I didn't go into the question of whether it should be a government-owned grid. I'm not sure that it has to be a government-owned grid. But it does mean that the grids will be developed so that they serve the purpose of transmission, interconnection, emergency supply, wholesale supply, everything that the high voltage grids or ultra high voltage grids do, on a basis where there will not be individual divided ownership or separate ownership, which is the case today, where every company has its own line, but there will be undivided ownership. There will be ownership in a group of lines, in which company A will have 9.333%, company B will have 11.9%, etc. Now, such ownership is already in existence in the case of power plants. It's undivided ownership. It's financed. It's owned literally by separate companies, different percentages. They mortgage it. The mechanism for that was developed, and it operates just as if you had an individual line of that capacity. Now, this means, though, it has this advantage. When you finally go to that public who says, why do you want that line? Besides, you need the line, but don't build it over my land. Why don't you build it over Bill's land, like my neighbor? He's got many more acres than I have. And the neighbor says, my land? I'll see you in hell first, you see. And I've seen that, you see. I don't know whether anybody can have a more uncomfortable feeling than I have. I hope there aren't too many people in this room. When you go out in the field, it doesn't matter whether it's in Virginia or Ohio or Indiana, and you go out somewhere in the country, and you take a look, and you look to the right of you, and you see for miles and miles a beautiful 345 kV extending, a double-circuit line, and then you see a gap, and then you see to the left of you, for as far as the eye can see, another line, and neither parts of that line are worth a damn because they're not connected, because there's a gap of 2.5 miles, and you've been blocked in every way possible, you see. Now, when you finally build that line, I think you need to examine your conscience, and to suppose you find that you needed 82% of that line, or 74%. You still couldn't build anything but that whole line. But if you built it on a basis of need in the area, you could be much surer that even if you build that line, provided somebody else had an undivided interest in it, that some other line in that whole area wouldn't be built, and some people owning land wouldn't have the burden of having lines built on their land unnecessarily. It's to answer the social question that the people as a whole who have given you the right to condemn their land. It's a terrific right that the utilities have, and they need to do everything to protect it, so that the way to protect it is to assure the people that under no conditions do they demand anything that is necessary for the optimum social good of the whole state community and that area community. This is what I meant by that.
Mr. Gould?
I know my friend Bill Gould doesn't agree with that, but I have no objection to this.
You know, I think I'm going to surprise both Phil Sporn and Mr. Olmsted. I think Mr. Olmsted asked this question because he felt that it was a firecracker, that it would go off. Because a few years ago, this was probably one of the hottest subjects in the industry, and we spent a lot of time debating it. However, the grim fact is, or not the grim fact, the pleasant fact is that here in California, we have a perfect example of what Phil Sporn was talking about. The DC intertie from the Columbia River Basin down to Sylmar, California, is a condition of a multiple ownership line. As far as the California-Nevada border, or I guess it's the Nevada-Oregon border, it's coming south, it's owned by Bonneville. South of there, it has a joint ownership of the California utilities, and it is on precisely the basis that Phil Sporn outlined. There are other facilities in California that are following that. Now, one of the things that's changed is this, that in the past, when we talked about this question, we were talking about a national grid that would suddenly overlay everybody and we would have czars dictating what we would have. We have in this country now some 8 reliability councils plus a national reliability council. These reliability councils, together with many joint planning councils that exist either coincident with them or alongside of them, have come up with this joint planning that has removed a lot of the sting from this. In other words, we're doing the job in our own neighborhood. And this is the situation in California. I think, again, that the Pacific Intertie was a perfect example of this.
Thank you, Mr. Gould. We have a young man over here that has a question.
Otto Smith, University of California. Regarding research and development, a question for Mr. Warren. Can you give us the dollar value and the proportion of a dollar revenue that is spent on research and development in the power industry and compare this with the same numbers in the electronics industry and in the chemical industry?
Well, I'm sure, as you know, the ratios there are, well, let me answer as you asked it. As I recall, for the electric utility industry, it depends a little bit on whose dollars you include in them, but if you include all those dollars, R&D dollars, the utilities spend themselves directly, as well as those which are spent by manufacturers and reimbursed through the purchase of equipment, I think even there the total number would be something like maybe 1/10 or 2/10 of 1%. In the highly technological industries, manufacturing industries, one finds corresponding numbers. Excuse me, I just expressed that as a percent of annual gross sales. That's what we're talking about. If you go to technological industries like the electronic, why one finds numbers which may be of the order of 5% and 10% of gross sales. Of course, they're working on very high obsolescence, and they must spend money like that to keep alive and keep competitive. In the chemical industries, it may be 3% or 4% of sales. So there's very real contrast in those numbers. And certainly one feels that in the kinds of R&D perspective that lies before the industry, that these percentages would have to go up above 1% of gross sales or something higher than that. That's my thought. But it's somebody else's operation that I'm talking about, and maybe some of those ought to speak to the subject. Mr. Sporn may have a comment.
Well, I'll be glad to say this. First place, I think there's just no comparison between a system like the utility systems of the United States and the electronic industries. See, the electronic industries are relatively small, isolated industries. There's very tough competition for the customer's dollar. And the customer, in the most advanced stages of research, is invariably the Department of Defense. And actually, in the case of the Department of Defense, there's almost no limit to expenditure on research, provided you get a product that does something a little better than something than somebody else's, you see. This is not the case when you get into matters such as electric power supply. You cannot spend money on that kind of a basis. The figures on what is altogether spent, if you take into account the fact that the electric utility systems of the country are spending something like $8 billion this year, and what they're spending it for is materials and labor, but such technological materials as steel and copper and aluminum and magnesium and many expensive alloys, and they spend it for such sophisticated items of equipment as atomic reactors, thermal reactors, by this I mean boilers that burn conventional fuels, turbines, transformers, switchgear, relay equipment, including electronic equipment. If you go back to all of these expenditures and add the research that's done there to give a product for the electric utility industry, and then take the research that's done directly by the industry, the figure is a fairly respectable figure. Whether it's as high as it should be is a matter of individual judgment. My own judgment has always been it could be higher, but certainly not on the basis of comparison with such industries as the electronic industries or the chemical industry, or let's say the ethical drug industry, you see, that can eventually produce a product that costs 5 cents to manufacture and that you can charge a dollar for when you sell it. Now, this isn't possible in power. It isn't possible in any other thing, very many other things, you see. And as a matter of fact, it isn't possible in drugs, as many of the drug manufacturers have found out when they got themselves in trouble later on with the government itself. So that this is a difficult thing to compare. The way to judge that is to find out what isn't being researched in electric power, in the development of better systems, more reliable systems, more economical systems, that might be researched with a fair hope of success, keeping in mind that research has an element of gambling in it all the time. And by that kind of a standard, it's possible to judge, to pass judgment that not enough money is being spent at the present time on research. And I rather think we're going to have a development in which there will be some persuasion used on the industry at various degrees of effectiveness to broaden their scope of research, and I think the industry will respond to this.
At the EEI meeting this year in Boston, Mr. Nasikas, Chairman of the Federal Power Commission, commented to the high ratio of expenditure by the telephone company as compared to the electric industry. It was about 6 or 7 to 1. Living in New York City, I hear quite a bit of criticism of the Con Ed electric service. But if you were there and compared it with the electric service, I think you would say, well, the telephone company should cut down on research expenditures and put a little bit in equipment, as Con Ed has done. We have time for one more question. A gentleman over here had his hand up quite a while ago.
My name is Patel, from Northeast Utilities. I'm interested to know from Mr. Swan what he's proposing regarding this limiting the population, that how he's going to face the religion aspect of it. Another question I have is about Mr. Hammond mentioned the problem in Calcutta.
I would like if, and I hope, excuse me.
Well, India is a poor country, and being a poor country, population is the biggest problem. Government of India is the only country, I think, in the world has taken some steps on official level to limit the population. However, the growth of population is so fast that whatever measure they are taking is not enough. What I would like to know is, what would the rich country do in order to help these countries to achieve their goal of stabilizing the population there? Because I feel that although you may solve problem here, if you do not solve problem in these countries, you're not going to have peace in the world. So I would like to know from the panels what their views are about this.
Well, I would like to comment on that, and I'd like to cover both your question and the point that Mr. Jim Watson made. I've done some work in CED, this is the Committee for Economic Development, over a dozen years or more on problems of the underdeveloped countries. The universal experience is, no matter what we do to bring an improvement in industry organization and in agricultural production, and in many cases we have marvelous records of what we have done in the way of improvement, all of that has invariably been negatived entirely by the increase in population. So what we ended up with is just a little less welfare, economic welfare, as a result of 15 years of work than we had before we started. And the answer is there. Of course, your efforts at control of population, since that is a very difficult matter, have not been sophisticated enough, they haven't been intensive enough, they just haven't been earnest enough and continuous enough. In many cases, there hasn't been enough help in the underdeveloped countries to bring this about. There is a program in the United Nations on population control in the underdeveloped countries, but I don't believe that it's the appropriations for it are one-tenth enough. And I think that the developed countries of the world have a great duty and responsibility, if they're interested in bringing economic welfare, spreading this economic welfare that we have managed to attain to the rest of the world. They've just got to do more in population control. But I also think they've got to do more in their own countries, you see. And this is in our countries like ours. And the question is, how do you do it? And my answer is, I know of no method that can possibly be effective in a nation like the United States, except education, continual effort, you see, of teaching people, showing them why it isn't necessary in order to have a full, happy family that they have three children or four children, and maybe two, if this is all that they can take care of, is the right number for them. And it's got to come by individual will. And this can be done, I think, over a long period of time if you work at it. But it isn't going to bring about any kind of quick relief. I think the most dreadful commentary on our society is the increase in population that we experienced in New York and adjacent areas during the period when we had the Northeast blackout in 1965. I think the fact that life was so uninteresting for these people, that this is the only way, you see, that they could find a way of spending their time, just means that we also have to give them a better way of living, you see.
Well, unless someone has a question they just can't withhold, I think we should give a little consideration to the panel and terminate this session. Mr. Sporn said he would like to say 1 minute's worth in closing.
Well, I'll try and stay within the minute. I first want to say to my fellow members of the panel, express to them my gratefulness for having obviously read and even studied my paper, and for their very intelligent comments on it, even where they differed with me, but I accepted their sincerity and certainly their intelligence in making their comments. I would like to comment on the point that I think was outstanding in each of the discussions, starting with Mr. Gould on my left. It seems to me that the point that he made much too quickly. He said at the very end, he said, individually and collectively, we have committed ourselves to a new ethic. I cannot tell you my own deep conviction of the importance of the item of ethics in human, individual, firm, professional, and corporate behavior. Here, about 3 months ago, I gave a talk at a very difficult campus, the campus of Wesleyan University in Connecticut. It's a disturbed campus with a very difficult problem they've tried to solve in making a complete, integrated school, a university. And they have about 25% of their school population is black. But unfortunately, it's not integrated. They've separated. But both groups are getting an education. Well, I expected a lot of difficult problems that I'd have to contend with in discussing this problem of environment and environmental control. But the angle which I discussed there was ethic. I discussed the problem of business, technology, morality, and ethics, and the interrelationship of all these items. So if it is a fact and I think it better be a fact, that we're going to bring more ethics into our consideration of these problems than I know. Then I know that what Mr. Wilkason ended his talk with, that he has a conviction that we know we can do it, he knows we will do it, and the question is how soon, that that will be sooner than anybody would expect. The important element there is to bring in ethics and morality. Now, on Phil Hammond's point, I think the important point that he made that we need to keep in mind is that all this hullabaloo that the scientific community, any number of whom made some cockeyed calculations that Dr. Hammond straightened them out on, you see, in the pages of science, you see, that we cannot release energy beyond a certain point or else we'll overheat the entire atmosphere, that all this is cockeyed mathematics, bad mathematics and bad science. And the fact that the energy that was released by man is only 1/25,000 of the total released by the sun is certainly a very important point in discussing this question of whether we have to put limits, you see. We need to spread that idea. That hasn't been spread as widely as Dr. Hammond believes it has, I'm afraid, you see. It's an important truth. And again, I've already stated that the important point that Commissioner Wilkason brought to us, I think, is very, very important. Now, I did answer, really, the very important point of Mr. Warren about research, that I believe that undoubtedly we could spend more effort on research in power to advantage to energy and its use in the service of man to everyone in the United States and elsewhere, you see. And finally, I did answer my friend Jim Watson about population control. It seems to me that nothing that we do in the world today of any importance can, in the final analysis, will add up to the importance of what will turn out to be what kind of solution we bring about in this this population problem. We are increasing population at the rate that is not yet, we are not in deep trouble yet, and undoubtedly the world population of about 3.5 billion can be increased to 7 billion or 7.5 billion and still not be, we'll not be in too much trouble. Think of that. And it'll happen in a matter of 35 or 40 years. But the question is, where do we go after that? We cannot afford any waste of time in underdeveloped, developing, and highly developed countries such as our own from waiting much longer to start working very effectively on this problem of population control, including all angles, the ethical, the moral, the religious. After all, there is such a thing as persuasion and new developments in the history of man, which I think could even move religious positions. But we cannot go ahead and tell religious people, the heck with your religion, you know, it just isn't going to work, and certainly isn't going to work in a society like ours. So we have a big job on our hands, how to get people thinking the right way about population. Population, which can be, having children, one of the greatest blessings in human experience, but there may be a point beyond which it's a blessing that is in too large a measure. With that, thank you very much.
Thank you, gentlemen. I want to say that I think we are certainly have been very fortunate, and we have a highly intellectual and intelligent and straightforward panel, and we owe them a debt of gratitude. Thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned.
Yes, hello.